I'd like to begin just to share a few things from yesterday. I found out some more about the word Hebrew. It comes from a word habiru or apiru, A-P-I-R-U. And when Moses, or when Abraham and Sarah came into the land, they joined a whole group of people in Palestine who were called Abiru, which simply meant like Bedouins. Today they were, unlike the landed people in the cities, they were the wandering nomad people, and they were all called Abiru. So eventually this name Abiru became Hebrew and was connected to one part of the Abiru, which were the people then that came out of Egypt, came out with the name Hebrew. No, I found it in Bernard Anderson.
Because what we learned was that there's some serious doubt as to whether that fact is where the word Hebrew came from.
Yeah, so don't write that down.
I got to take away one solid fact, please.
No. I'd like to read two passages. If you're a Jewish person, this is your creed. Now, this is what you would learn from the time you're a little child. And notice how it sets your identity. This is a Jewish person would just tell one story, and I'm going to change it from father to parents. My parents were wandering Aramaeans, and they went down into Egypt to find refuge there, few in number. But there they became a nation great, mighty, and strong. And the Egyptians ill-treated us. And notice how every Jewish person says us, not them. Now, this is our family story. The Egyptians ill-treated us. They gave us no peace and inflicted harsh slavery on us. But we called on Yahweh, the God of our fathers. Yahweh heard our voice and saw our misery, our toil, and our oppression. And Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with mighty hand and outstretched arm, with great terror and with signs and wonders. And Yahweh brought us here and gave us this land, a land where milk and honey flow. Here then I bring the first fruits of the produce of the soil that you, Yahweh, have given me. That's a creed of Israel. That along with Deuteronomy 6, which is called the Shema. Am I right? Listen, Israel, Yahweh our God is one Yahweh, or the Lord our God is one Lord, is the way Jewish people, I think, would say. And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. Then it goes on to say about these words, let these words I urge on you today be written on your heart. You shall repeat them to your children and say them over to them, whether at rest in your house or walking abroad, at your lying down or your rising, and you shall fasten them on your hand as a sign. Orthodox Jewish people wear these words. In your forehead as a circlet. Orthodox people also wear it on the forehead. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house. The Jewish home has a little box with these words in them. So every time you go in and out of your house, you touch the box to remember the Shema. The Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. Now, I'd like to ask something I'd like to do, and if you'd, one is easy, the other would be harder, but would you be willing to memorize these two to be really, to really claim our roots as people that carry the story of the Exodus? And would that be an okay for 10 weeks? And part of it, I think, would be it would make a Jewish person feel wonderful if you say, yeah, I know those.
We learned that in confirmation class.
You did? So you already know the,
well,
the one.
Yes, and others.
Yeah. So.
What is?
Give us a scripture.
Deuteronomy 6, 4 and 5. Or really 6, 4, I think. No, 4 and 5. And Deuteronomy 26, really 5 through 10. But it might be good if we could print it out in a way we could learn it together, and then we can say it together. So maybe several of us could get together and decide on a good version. And sometimes when you speak out loud, it's better to say Lord than Yahweh. To Jewish people, you don't say the word Yahweh. You don't speak that word with your mouth. Because there's such deep respect for the name of God that you never say it. You only read it. It's one question about our inclusive language matins. For a Jewish person to come here on a Sunday morning and hear us saying Yahweh in worship would be very offensive. You know, and it's a thought when that service is rewritten of being more sensitive about saying that name in worship. These are little trivial pursuit things. Probably the Pharaoh of Egypt that Moses actually spoke to was Ramses II. And he was a great builder. If you go to Egypt today, you see so many ruins of the buildings of Ramses II. And Karen and I, a long time ago, were on an Old Testament study tour, seminary class in Egypt on Old Testament studies. And I think one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life is that the mummified body of Ramses II is in a museum in Cairo, and you can get within 2 feet of his face. And to actually, if this is accurate, that it was Ramses II that Moses talked to, it's amazing that you can actually be as close to the face as Ramses II as Moses was. And just stand there and say, my goodness, Moses looked right into this face. Oh, no. And sometime when Elmer's out of the village, I'd like to show that slide. Another really foundation story that we shouldn't pass by is from Exodus 3. And let's, before we move on today, let's look at that. Exodus 3, 13 through 15. This is when, if you remember the story of Moses, how he is raised in the court of Pharaoh. Remember, he's found in the bushes, in the reed basket in the bushes, and brought to Pharaoh's palace, raised as a royal Egyptian, but his mother becomes his babysitter. Remember the story? And therefore, he is raised by his mother as an Egyptian. He's thought to be an Egyptian, but she evidently whispers his Hebrew identity into his ear as he's being raised. Knowing his identity, he sees one of the Hebrew slaves being mistreated by an Egyptian overlord, and then he kills the overlord, and then he has to run and flee from Egypt. And while he's fleeing, and now God is calling him back to free the people, that's when he runs into what's called the burning bush. And this is where God reveals God's name to Moses. And remember the power of a name in biblical mentality. If you know a person's name, you have power over them. Remember Jacob wrestling with the angel, you know, tell me your name. That was very important to have power over another person, and how vulnerable you were to ever give your name out to another person. That was to be vulnerable with that person. I'll just read. He sees the burning bush that doesn't go out and says, this is verse 3, I must go and look at this strange sight, Moses said, and see why the bush is not burnt. Now Yahweh saw him go forward to look, and God called to him from the middle of the bush. Moses, Moses, he said, and God knows his name. Here I am, he answered. Come no nearer, he said, but take off your shoes, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. I am the God of your father, he said, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And at this, Moses covered his face, afraid to look at God. Yahweh said, I have seen the miserable state of my people in Egypt. I have heard their appeal. Now, I'm going to skip down to verse 13, because God tells how God has seen the plight of the people and how he's going to send Moses down to 13. Moses said to God, I am to go then to the sons of Israel, children of Israel, and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. But if they ask me what his name is, what am I to tell them? And God said to Moses, and this is the word name now, Yahweh, I am who I am. And some translators say it's much more accurate to say God says, I will be who I will be. This, he added, is what you must say to the sons of Israel. I will be has sent me to you. Imagine what you think this person comes. Who sent you? I will be. And Charlie Mays, who teaches Bible here at Holden, calls God the big verb. The big verb. Now notice immediately here the Jewish understanding that you don't philosophize the existence of God. That it's just both I am and I will be emerging in the world. I will be acting in the world. God is a verb to the Hebrew, and to the Greek, God is a noun. Do you get the difference? Noun or verb. Okay, now I'd like to go back to Egypt. We got out of Egypt. And just to keep this triangle in context, you know, with Egypt, you had God, the gods up here, Pharaoh, and then the overlords, the administrators, the citizens, and then the slaves. And then the radical statement about a God who enters into the world of the slaves to upset the system. And then how the role of religion then is to make this, what is static here, make it static forever. To give it a divine justification. That becomes the role of a religion. And one interesting thing, how, if we were going to make a triangle of American society, you know, it wouldn't be the same as this because we don't have a king and a divine right of a king and going down. Or here, whatever you were born into, that was your God-ordained status for your whole life. But just look at the triangle and what would be some... First of all, would we have a triangle that's a hierarchy? Dumb question. And how, you know, I think we would, but how would it be different? Think of Horatio Alger. Who would be at the, would we still have a god at the top?
Mm-hmm. Probably. Wall Street.
Many corporations.
God, and I don't know, who would be on top?
Reagan or corporations?
Maybe we could just guess. Maybe we would say people with power and money. Who would be at the bottom? Money.
No power, no money.
No power, no money. No money, no power. And we're just... And then one picture I was thinking of is that this would be the Horatio Alger. Do you get it? I mean, it's something you didn't have in Egypt, but we have little stairs. The stairs we can climb. And then also the hierarchical way of thinking, you know, we don't have slaves, but then it's could be even further divided according to our to attitudes. You know, you could start with God here, and then, and this is how sometimes the Bible is interpreted. You know, then you have white male, white female, male of color, female of color, animals, rocks. You know, then you go down the whole line of nature, and then you have a hierarchy of importance. And then the one that is on top, you then are the boss over the one below you. You have the power over the one below you until you get down to the rocks and to the inanimate objects in nature. And it's a whole hierarchy of dominance. If the Exodus story will become our myth, and that is the call of the story, is for it to become our myth, then we have to start to ask, well, what does a God mean today that enters into this to shatter it? No, and I don't want to get ahead because I have an assignment on that, but Let's just think of the process, and I want to turn to Numbers and show what these people left. Numbers 11. This is when they're already out in the wilderness. And the people are complaining about being in the wilderness, and they're forgetting that how bad it was to be slaves, and they're remembering what they had in Egypt. Numbers 4:11. Who will give us meat to eat, they said, and think of the fish we used to eat free in Egypt. Think of the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. Wow. Can't you just see them out in the desert with their backpacks and their trail lunches? Here we are wasting away, stripped of everything. There's nothing but manna for us to look at. And we're going to get to manna later today. But here we have the story that became the foundation myth or the foundation narrative of these people that informed their whole identity and their whole life. And that was slavery in Egypt. Even if you were secure, you were fed, you were slaves. And then liberation, the mighty act of God of salvation. And I remember in the Old Testament, salvation is as far divorced as going to heaven when you die as you could get. Now, salvation was God's act of getting us across the water and God's act of getting the Egyptians caught in the mud, and then our celebration when we got on the other side, and then our moving into the wilderness and on to the promised land. This is a story now that informs identity and informs life. Now, I want to try this just to never leave when we're studying the Bible where we are today, and that is to just buzz for a few minutes. Should we do it in twos? Is that okay? Just like two, 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 two. Begin to ask the question, how would this story become a foundation narrative for that would make sense out of my life today in my situation and in my society? You know, what is my Egypt, or what is our Egypt? What does it mean to leave Egypt? What does it mean to have that shattered? What does it mean to move to something new for us? Is that clear? What we could just talk about for a few minutes, and so just buzz with the person next to you, or should we? How many minutes do you think? Just six. Is that long? Okay.
Identifying with it, I mean, and anything that seemed to have any significance related to being enslaved. There are times that. Well, I mentioned when I left St. Olaf, it was like, I'm serious. Yeah. As far as being a place that wasn't working for me.
My first reaction was to talk about the system again, to talk about leaving the capitalist system and how I can see that as an individual, but I can't really picture it as a metaphor, as a people. I can't imagine a group of people leaving. To speak, and yet I realized that here, even then, I was being abstract. Instead of saying, okay, instead of talking about the time when I was like, then before we talked about it, I realized when I was in Europe, I felt in bondage because I couldn't speak to people in the same language. I couldn't speak Italian well enough to be able to communicate, and it was so freeing to be back home again and to be able to talk with people. I felt really. And the whole time I kept on feeling, oh, I should just love Europe. You know, here is the chance of a lifetime, and yet I felt so alone.
I identified with, with Israel in my struggle to leave my job. For the last few years, I was unhappy with it. And I was became increasingly admitted that to myself, but I was making good money, and it was safe. And I could forget it, but as soon as the job was over, I could go home and kind of block that out. And feel very nice and cozy. And when I finally did decide to quit, I wondered about that. I had reservations. I guess I was like going in the wilderness too. Before I quit, I'd always wanted to know what I was going to do next before I quit. So I finally got to the point where I knew I didn't know where I was going to go next. So I knew I just had to quit and wander. And so
Bob is in the wilderness.
So am I, Bob. Me too.
And at least what I'm seeing now, when we start to see a biblical spirituality, I think wilderness is a wonderful metaphor of what our life is. And I'll see if that becomes more clear. Anyone else?
I feel like this is the only way to God. And it's another way I can see how I am in some way complaining about, you know, I'm thinking, well, I quit my job, so I left, but now that I'm out there, you know, I'm free from a lot of the things, but I'm complaining because I don't have enough to eat, you know, like in a metaphorical sense, I don't have the money that I feel I need. At the same time, complaining and feeling like grumbling and saying, man,
wish maybe you were back. Sometimes wish you were back.
Yeah, right. Sometimes thinking, why did I ever, you know, quit and leave that security and that safety?
So it ever looked like the place of watermelons and
Yeah. Garlic. And
garlic. What are leeches?
Leeks.
Leeks. Where did I get leeches? Oh, right. I'm seeing it more and more in this model as how, it helps to try to develop a model of Egypt, you know, of our Egypt, you know, and if this might be getting close to it, I think how secure it would be for me to fit in. In the institution and in the church, you know, the seduction to fit in, justify it, affirm it, not question it, and how to begin that questioning is really moving into the wilderness for me. I think I could be very secure. But Bob and I were sharing, it's almost once you've started the journey, you can't turn back. Do any of you feel that once you're on the journey?
I feel that,
yeah.
What's
that?
40 years.
40 years. Yeah. Yeah.
I was saying, sharing that I'm finding a real hard time connecting being Christian and being capitalist, that I don't see them together anymore.
That's scary.
Yeah. I said, what else is there? What are the options?
What? I don't have any great expectations that that will be totally rectified in my lifetime. But at least I like to have little pockets here and there, you know, where you don't have to deal with the issue. Occasional rests from the story.
And that's in the story, they stop at Oasis. It says.
But is it an oasis in the wilderness? Or is it,
you know, a mini exodus, temporary. Is it a mini exodus? Yeah. Well, like, in some places you can be free of those things. Or is it the wilderness in the sense of a long journey that's happening with oasis? I experience it as the oasis. It took me a long time to get there.
And
but that's amazing.
It's a long journey, and thank goodness for the oases.
Yeah. Could it be a prayer for this place that it be an oasis?
Mm-hmm.
I'll maybe move on, but if this can begin to show us the power of what we call myth. And now notice once the Jewish people always started saying, this story is our life, then the questions about, is this true or not, begin, do you understand how they begin to kind of fall? You would start to say, this is so real, this story. And then as we move on, we're going to see how the Christians, the early Christians in the New Testament, will see the death and resurrection of Jesus as the new Exodus, and then that becomes a foundation story, but it's a foundation story based on this, so this is a foundation story of the Christ event. First, we'll get to that, but it's, and then finally to have faith is to kind of say, ah, this story is my story, it's the story of my life, death and resurrection, you know, into the shadowy places of death. And you know.
Did you talk about, when I was getting the vacuum cleaner, about liberation theology, black theology?
Oh, no, will you? Can you mention that?
Well, just that, as I understand them, that the Exodus story is the foundation story for for these new theologies, not that new, fairly new, that people who have been at the bottom in their cultures see this Christian, Judeo-Christian story as their story. God is on the side of the oppressed. So very, very powerful for Central America and for black.
I remember Martin Luther King's speeches. You know, the old ways of slavery and discrimination, you know, this was Egypt, and I remember him calling them the flesh pots of Egypt, you know, we will not go back. Now we're on the journey, we're on our way to the promised land. And remember his speech just before he died, the day before he was assassinated, he says, he saw himself as Moses. You know, I've been to the mountain and I've seen the promised land. You know, and I still get goosebumps. I think I've seen the promised land. This story is a story of black Americans. And maybe the story is hardest for us because we are not the oppressed. And, you know, I'm speaking as a white male. Well, now I want to continue our story now and get the people out into the wilderness. And we're going to move here now to Exodus 16. And now, remember how yesterday I called the wilderness now the school. And again, if we could form the picture of God as in the Jim Fish phrase, as a hot-blooded Hebrew lover. And I like here to be very, what we call anthropomorphic, of just thinking of God and in creation-centered spirituality. To think of God who has been in love with creation for billions and billions of years, if you want to put it in time. And now in these latter days, the last seconds in the history of the world, this sad thing has happened. There's this one planet where everything is kind of disrupted. And the human beings on this planet are just messing themselves up by this type of thing. And one thing the most important thing I wanted to mention about this hierarchy, it depends on division. Division between people, division between people and nature, and people against people, of dividing people and separating them. And if you think of a God that loves this whole creation and wants it all to work, so these creatures that God loves are happy. I'll just put it in that simple word, happy. The lover God just says, what am I going to do about this? What am I going to do? And now faith, seeing acts of revelation, I would say what God decided to do was to start with this little group of slave people in Egypt. And they carried out of Egypt with them a memory. And that is a memory of their ancestor, Abraham, and Sarah, and God's promise. And let's just look at that quickly before we get out to the wilderness. Genesis 11, or is it 12? Genesis 12, 1. Yahweh said to Abram, leave your country, your family, and your father's house for the land I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name so famous that it will be used as a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you. And think of Matthew Fox now in the word blessing. I will curse those who slight you, and then all the tribes of the earth shall bless themselves by you. That they carry with them this promise that someday every tribe and family and people on this earth is going to be shalomed, and we'll be using that word more and more. They're going to be shalomed. And simply means to be brought into the harmony that God intends for all of creation. That's going to happen, and it'll be through us. They carry this memory of their ancestor who believed that somehow his offspring and Abraham and Sarah's offspring would shalom the earth. And now, now we go out into the wilderness. And now I think, this is what I think, that God now wants to take a people in a world that tends to be set up this way in the Egyptian model and say, I want to mold a people that will live a difference. I want to mold a people that will live a different way. And we'll say again, that's the shalom way. And I'll raise them like a child, this people. I'll teach them as you teach a child. So then that they will be a light to the rest of the world, and the rest of the world will look and say, ah, that is the way to live. That's shalom. And now the teaching begins, and now it comes. This is one of my favorite stories in the Bible, and it's the story about the manna. And here I think we begin to see the spirituality that God now gives to these people. And it's connected to the way they share their bread. Where should we begin? I'm just, to save time, I'm just going to read the parts of it. And then just encourage you to read all of 16. The people are complaining now. Like we said, do you ever wish you could go back to the security of former slaveries? When everything was kind of well-ordered and well-planned and well-provided. And that's what they said. Why did we not die at Yahweh's hand in the land of Egypt when we were able to sit down to pans of meat and could eat bread to our heart's content? Notice how they're forgetting what it was really like. As it is, you have brought us to this wilderness to starve this whole company to death. Then Yahweh said to Moses, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I will rain down bread for you from the heavens. Each day the people are to go out and gather the day's portion. And I propose to test them in this way to see whether they will follow my law or not. And on the sixth day, when they prepare what they have brought in, this will be twice as much as a daily gathering. In other words, on Friday you get double manna, so it'll hold you over Saturday. Then skip over to verse 16. And this is Yahweh's now command about the sharing of manna. And think about how different this is in Egypt now. This is Yahweh's command. Everyone must gather enough of it for his needs. The picture here now is the man for his family going out to gather the manna. One omer a head, which is about a quart, according to the number of persons in your families. Each of you will gather for those who share his tent. The sons of Israel did this. They gathered it, some more, some less. When they measured in an omer what they had gathered, the man who had gathered more had not too much. The man who had gathered less had not too little. Each found he had gathered what he needed. And Moses said to them, no one must keep any of it for tomorrow. But some would not listen to Moses and kept part of it for the following day. These are the midnight snackers. What? Look what happened to it. It bred maggots and smelled. What is your translation?
Bred worms and became foul.
Yeah, and became foul. Or this says it smelt foul, rotten. And Moses was angry with them. Mad, mad, mad. Morning by morning they gathered it, each according to their needs. And when the sun grew hot, it dissolved. You know, if we could unravel the story, I think we have, we'll be getting at what I think is the center of the spirituality now that God would teach the people. So let's erase this and replace it. First of all, you have God. And what does God give? Manna. And someone wants to look up in the Bible dictionary all the different ideas of what this manna actually was.
Like coriander.
It was something that was available in the wilderness to eat.
Question. Coriander. It's a spice we use now.
you know, then God gives this manna. And how is the manna distributed? Or how do the people take?
As much as they made it.
Yeah. Okay. If you have a, say, if you have a big family, you have more. If you have a little family, you have less. And each family according to their needs. Now, right away you have an understanding of what food and all of the gifts of creation are for. They're simply to have enough to sustain one so one can live what life is really about. And let me state that, and then that's an idea that can be tested as we go through the Bible. That God wants to create a family here that will see food and then beyond that, all material possessions are all, not erase that word, gifts of creation. Completely erase what I just, the material possessions, but gifts of creation, that would see gifts of creation as a way of sustaining one to live what life is all about. And that is the, again, we could call the shalom of living in harmony with God and human community and with nature. That's an idea. And then Elmer added anything else that might exist. Remember? So that will be the plus. Anything else that might exist. Okay, how much do you get? Do you get enough for the next week? Or how much manna do you get?
Enough for today.
Daily. Did anybody already see the seeds of a great religious teacher years later that will write a prayer? Give us this day our daily bread. Now, we're going to look at that in a couple of weeks when we get to Jesus' home. Jesus, even in the Lord's Prayer, is teaching manna spirituality and teaching a people to live manna spirituality. Daily bread. Now, in my reading more and more about this, the manna picture, is that what happens when one group of people takes more manna to try to save it for tomorrow, and some have more. Mentally and spiritually, you move yourself from one spirituality to another spirituality. And that is, I'm not quite clear what words to use, but one is the receiving of food as a gift to the controlling, to the control of nature for my benefit. And I wish I could say this more clearly and more, but let's work on it as we go. The difference between living with creation as gift and living with creation as controller. As later in the story of Jesus, the barn builder. I hope that first, let me just stop now. Do you get a sense of the difference between gift and control? Now, to move this out of strictly manna, let's enlarge the pictures. Did I miss anything that you'd see in this story of the manna? But underscore again the mentality of seeing now the gifts of creation is not your meaning in life, but rather the sustaining thing that keeps you so you can be part of what the meaning of life is. And control means that I start to use the gift to be that which gives me my identity and my meaning. You know, I'm the one that has double manna. And that becomes my pride and my identity. And that's why the humor of this passage there stinks.
And
had it put on in number 8, I guess. They gathered it and ground it in mills and beat it in mortars and boiled it in pots and made cakes. They put it in like a taste of cake steak with oil, which I guess they didn't have in the wilderness.
If you want to read another humorous story, it's Numbers 11 is where, you know, where the people decide they want meat, and God drops so many birds on them, they all get sick. And they have all these dead birds all lined up in meat, and I think they've really made it. They're back in Egypt now, again with all of this meat. The Bible has a vegetarian bias. Notice that the Garden of Eden is a vegetarian place. So that, where was I? I was going to enlarge this chart now to think of the difference now between the Egyptian model and now the manna model, is that God is a giver of all good gifts, the gifts of creation. Food and the water and the sunshine and all that is given to sustain us and to keep us. And then the receivers are all the human beings of the world, plus all the flowers, trees, animals, and everything are the receivers of God's creation. And the manna picture is that there's enough for all, but there's not enough for greed. There's enough for all. And I got a sense of this from Russell Walder, Holden agronomist, who said that if we would learn how to be tender with the earth just can't wait to give. The earth, he says, is anxious to give. It's just excited to give. He says if we do it right, the earth would give 5 times as much food as would feed the whole population of the world today. That if we would caress the earth instead of mining it, is the word he uses. You can argue with him, but that's what he, 5 times he says, we could feed 5 times the world population if we would just let the earth give the bounty that the earth wants to give in its heart. This is the gifts of creation, enough for all. And now this will move us into the model of the wonderful life in the Bible is not poverty. Except the special meaning of the word poverty is receiving daily bread, but it's an abundant feast for everybody that's shared with everybody. And this already leads us to the picture of how Jesus in his ministry just all he seemed to want to do is eat, and share food with people who were left out and didn't have it and were poor and were the outcasts. We'll ask the question when we get to Jesus, was he painting a picture of man alive in the ministry of Jesus? Well, that's the story. That's the teaching now of the manna. And I want to use this now during our weeks as we do the Bible survey as to use this story and follow the meaning of this story through the Bible into Jesus, into the life of the early church, and even into the Revelation. Ask that question, is this a foundation now for the spirituality that we're called to live? A different model that's similar that Paul Hansen used here at Holden was now, the model now of the wilderness people is one, a model of equality. This is the sharing of gifts set up of the Shalom community. Now, the way it's set up politically is this way, is it? God is the ruler of this people, and everyone is equal. Now, radical departure from the Egyptian model. Everyone is equal under God. It's an egalitarian society now on the wilderness. And then the way this egalitarian society is to work is, and Paul traces this through the Bible, is a triangle of God, righteousness, and I think what he meant by righteousness was just the harmony of the society of being set up right. So everyone is taken care of. And then the other side of the triangle is compassion. That all through the Old Testament community and the laws and the rules, there's a bias towards those who in the Egyptian model would land to the bottom. A compassion that they always be remembered to make sure the society doesn't slip into the Egyptian model. So he said that he showed how the prophets call for the balance of this triangle. But think now, the manna was the economic life of this community of the wilderness, and then the political life of this community is an egalitarian society under the lordship of God, for the rulership of God. Now this is the society that's going to try to exist in the world. And when we get to them demanding a king, they're going to say, we want to be like other people.
Dan, how about the position of Moses, though, as far as...
Okay. We'll get to that when we get to the judges. Now, when the people enter the land, the book of Deuteronomy, I'll get to that, but I want to say this. The book of Deuteronomy, the large part of the book is Moses giving them a bunch of sermons at the border before they go into the land. And the sermons are this: how can you be a wilderness people when you're landed? You're going to enter the land. How can you be a wilderness people and follow the wilderness life when you live on the land? And then, so when they enter the land, they try this, and it's a very Moses type of model. Nobody ever decided, Moses was never the king of these people, but when the confederation of tribes, and that's what we have now moving through the wilderness, we have a confederation of clans. And they all get along by the covenant law that is given by the ruler God. That's how you get along. But once in a while there's a crisis, and at that time of crisis, God will raise up a charismatic person to lead us for a while. And when the crisis is over, that person re-enters the egalitarian. And the way the people will obey that person is not that he has any divine kingly right, but just he has charisma, or she has charisma. There were women judges. That person has a charisma to lead us through this crisis and wins our respect. So now, as we move into the land, the question is, how do you live this way in the real world? And then I'm going to work on this. Is the early church in the book of Acts an attempt to restructure the wilderness society? To me, it's one of the most exciting connections I can find in the Bible, is that the early church, I think, made an honest attempt to say, we are going to live as a new wilderness people. But I can't not jump ahead like that. Well, then, we have 7 minutes. I'm going to do the marriage. Let's just read it. Exodus. Exodus 19. Now we move into a word that most of us have heard. It's called covenant, which was an ancient way of the Semitic peoples to set up agreements between themselves. And a covenant simply meant two parties making a promise to each other. And there were two kinds of covenants: one, a covenant of equals, and the covenant of unequals. And this is a covenant now of what would be called unequals, God the Creator and the people. And notice they're getting ready now for almost like a wedding. Chapter 19, verse 10. Yahweh said to Moses, go to the people and tell them to prepare themselves today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothing and hold themselves in readiness for the third day, because on the third day Yahweh will descend on the mountain of Sinai in the sight of all the people. Do you catch the excitement of almost getting ready for a wedding? Get your clothes ready and get everything ready. You will, now look how they're preparing for the wedding. This is the planning committee. You will mark out the limits of the mountain and say, take care not to go up the mountain or to touch the foot of it, and whoever touches the mountain will be put to death. This is serious. No one must lay a hand on him. He must be stoned or shot by an arrow, whether man or beast. You know, if your dog goes up on this mountain, it's kind of, you know, the holiness of this mountain now for the wedding. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they are to go up the mountain. So Moses came down from the mountain to the people and bade them prepare themselves, and they washed their clothing. Then he said to the people, be ready for the third day. And it says, do not go near any women. Now at daybreak, on the third day, there were peals of thunder on the mountain and lightning flashes, a dense cloud and a long trumpet blast, and inside the camp all the people trembled. And then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the bottom of the mountain. To get a picture of this, I have to look at times when the clouds are down other mountains here. Do you know what I mean? And it just looks like the gods could be coming and descending on buckskin and copper. And the mountain of Sinai was entirely wrapped in smoke because Yahweh had descended on it in the form of fire. And like smoke from a furnace, the smoke went up and the whole mountain shook violently. Are you seeing how the Hebrews were more poetic people than essayists? Okay. Louder and louder grew the sound of the trumpet, and Moses spoke, and God answered with peals of thunder. And Yahweh came down on the mountain of Sinai, on the mountaintop. And Yahweh called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And Yahweh said to Moses, go down and warn the people not to pass beyond their bounds, to come and look on Yahweh. On many of them, or many of them, will lose their lives. In the book of Revelation, you have the final scene is the ban being lifted, and humanity looks into the face of God. Is a parallel to this. Even the priests, I'm skipping a little, even the priests must purify themselves, or Yahweh will break out against them. And Moses answered Yahweh, the people cannot come up the mountain of Sinai because you warned us yourself when you said, mark out the limits of the mountain and declare it sacred. Go down, said Yahweh to him, and come up again bringing Aaron with you. But do not allow the priests or the people to pass beyond their bounds to come up to Yahweh, or he will break out against them. So Moses went down to the people, and then he spoke these words from God. I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And therefore now this is the shalom life that I give to you as a gift. Here it is. And now we go into first the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments, and then law after law after law, which Jewish people call our joy. You know, Lutherans call it the pain that drives us to despair. Jewish people say this is gospel. That we are given. We are given this life. We are given this life of shalom, of enjoyment, of happiness. And now what, so we're not going to meet for 3 weeks. So I'm going to, could I have 5 more minutes? Mm-hmm. Hey, what else could you say?
Would you like to change places? What? Do it Tuesday?
I think we can wait.
Okay.
I just want to share just a list. This should only just take 5 minutes because it now shows how the law fits into manna living. But one thing about manna living is that everything is God's. Nothing belongs to you. It's given as a gift. We own nothing, but it's given. Now, first of all, and I just want this to be on our minds, and then when we meet again, first of all, we'll notice when they enter the land, the land is divided like manna. Bigger families, bigger plots, littler families, little plots. The land is divided like manna. And then the law now carries manna living into the agricultural life now that they enter into the land. And I'm going to just list these now, and then when we meet again in a couple of weeks, we can talk about them more. First is the tithe. The first tenth of everything goes to God to remind you that nothing belongs to you. And the fun of the tithe was that you got to eat your whole tithe. You just brought it to the temple or to a worship place and had a feast there with it. But it's just a reminder to you that this is a gift of God. So you go to the holy place and eat it. Only every third year the tithe went completely to the poor and the foreigners in the land. Every third year. And over in the law, people are reminded, this isn't yours. It's not yours. And it's also, and have compassion on the foreigners. You were foreigners in Egypt. Then, secondly, there were these wonderful laws that you would always be reminding yourself that it didn't belong to you, but it only was given to you to sustain you. Never cut up to the end of your field. Always leave some stuff around. That's for the people that are having bad luck, or the stranger that's walking through, or the animals, or whoever wants it. Doesn't belong to you, so don't go up to the edge. When you shake a tree, only shake it so many times so you'll leave some of the fruit in it. That doesn't belong to you. Now leave some for the people that are walking through. You pile up a little extra money. Somebody needs it, you loan it to them. You can't charge interest. It's inconceivable that you would make money off of your excess. Then the Sabbath day was a reminder that getting all of this stuff isn't the most important thing in life. But gathering your grain only sustains you for the Sabbath. And in the manna community, you have enough so you can do what life is all about, and that is to rest. And it was rest was the model of what life really is, and the rest, the working part of your life, was to sustain you for the rest. If you were married, you got to take a year off from work. Every seventh year, this is a Sabbath year, every seventh year you don't plant any crops. You take the year off to rest, and let the land rest, and let your beasts rest, and let everybody rest. This is the Sabbath rest. And also, every seventh year too, if anybody has become a slave, they're free. The seventh year. And also in the seventh year, all debts are canceled. You know, if you've loaned out some money and the seventh year comes, you say, forget it, it's yours. Because you didn't need it anyway, right? If you loaned it out, you didn't need it. So you say, forget it. Never muzzle the ox that's treading on your grain.
And you said that morning, I pushed you. I drank juice when you got done pouring.
Don't use your animals, but let them eat all they want. You know, one of the fun things about reading the law is the laws about animals eating people's crops. You know, that's
fun. Blackbirds can all
milk suits. Yeah. Okay, now, and then the most fantastic, and then that's where I want to pick up next time, is the year of Jubilee. Every 50th year, this is what happens. The hierarchy might be starting, the Egyptian model of some people being rich or some people being poor. Some people lose their land because of bad luck or hardship. That begins. So every 50th year is like Monopoly, going back to go. Everybody goes back and starts over again. If you've sold some land to somebody else because of hard times, the Jubilee year, the horn blows and you get your land back. Everything goes back to its original owner. Or you're in debt again, debts are canceled. You're a slave, slaves are free. And then also on the Jubilee year, again, there's no planting or harvesting, but the main thing, all property is restored. So again, you go back to the manna equality every 50th year.
Did they come by the say like this one, did they set that up at the beginning, or was this all evolving as they went along?
Oh, yeah. When you read in the Bible, the law looks like it was given right from Moses off the mountain. But the setting of it is so agricultural, you know, that it seems strange that all these agricultural rules would have been given in the wilderness. So probably it was read back in, and then, but I read last night that probably the Ten Commandments come from Moses. And probably other parts of it were the teaching of Moses. And then when they entered the land, was taking the spirit of Moses and applying it now to the agricultural setting in which they lived.
Where did the slaves come from if it was an equal society?
If you really got into bad times, that would be the worst thing that could happen to you. You would become a slave. You could become a slave of another person, but you could never become a slave more than 7 years if you were a Hebrew, to another Hebrew. Somehow people did these things, like have slaves, but then the law had a way of getting everything back to gold. So it would never become, like in Egypt, a permanent thing that was justified by a divine static system. You notice how it's a constant revolution. You know, you don't need to wait 150 years for finally an army to get a revolution together. You have a revolutionary life going on all the time.
How much do you think the year of Jubilee was actually practiced?
That's a question of scholars. You know, for a while, it was almost never. Then now there's more indication, especially the time of the judges. And then the reforms, was it Hezekiah reform? There might have been some Jubilee things restored. And also a lot of loopholes, especially during the time of the kings, all kinds of loopholes to get out of it. And where we're going to lead now, again, when we get to Jesus, was when Jesus announced in the synagogue in Luke, when he proclaimed the year of the Lord's favor, was he proclaiming a Jubilee year? These connections really, to me, I think we'll see, will get exciting. Well, that's, I'm going to have some reading before I'll leave a reading thing before I go on my trip. Then we'll pick this up in 2 or 3 weeks. One thing I would kind of suggest is that I think the three best tapes in the tape library are Walter Brueggemann, called The Inculturation of the Church, a boring sounding name for tapes. The Inculturation of the Church. And there are three tapes on the Moses speeches as the people are ready to go into the Promised Land from the wilderness, and asking the question, how can you be a wilderness people when you become landed? And then he asks the question of us, when we're a landed people, how do we live as wilderness people? And one question he asks in the tape, how do you pray for daily bread when you own the bakery? But they're excellent tapes, so I'd suggest those. So Walter Brueggemann, they're three. He's also entertaining. You'll enjoy the tapes, a lot of laughs. So. Okay.
Before they go, I just have a real brief assignment for Tuesday. That is simply to come with a definition of feminism. What you think it is, what it means to you.
Judy, do you want to say anything about the books for us today?
No, other than it's going to be geared mostly for winter program people to try to pull out things that I think would be relating to what you're talking about.
B30
in the bookstore.
Thank you for your kindness of letting me go over today.